interview with Henry Fry, Associate Justice, North Carolina Supreme Court, on Monday, August 21, 1995, for the North Carolina Politics Project series for the Southern Oral History Program at UNC Chapel Hill. My name is Joe Monnier, M-O-S-N-I-E-R. I'm a graduate student in the History Department conducting this interview for the North Carolina Politics Project series. The interview is being conducted in Justice Fry's chambers at the North Carolina Supreme Court in Raleigh. The cassette number is 8.21.95-HF. Justice Fry, can you just say a test and we'll see if...
Hello, testing, one, two, three, four, five.
Looks great, okay. I'd like to start with a question about... Well, it's a range of questions associated with the question, the evolution of black political activity in North Carolina since the passage of the Voting Rights Act, and open with, if you can share your reflections on the nature of black political leadership across the state, say, in the mid-60s, when, and including the experience of being appointed as assistant U.S. attorney in 63.
Well, those were the Kennedy years nationally, rather short period of time, of course, as you know, and we were going through the stage of some dismantling of the dual system of doing things primarily in the South, to some extent, of course, in the North, and several blacks were beginning to vote and to especially in the cities, and to have some effect on the elections, and generally, though, where there were partisan elections, it was largely the Democratic primary where the decisions were made. Because except for those areas of the state where we had a few Republicans, everything was, the primary was it, the Democratic primary. And, of course, most blacks who were registered as Democrats. Mm-hmm. And as far as my appointment to the United States Attorney's Office, at that time there had not been a black in the United States Attorney's Office as an assistant attorney. In this century, at least, and the question was who was going to break the ice and when it was going to be broken, and whether it was going to be in the West or the East or the Middle District. And the Middle District was considered to be probably a little more advanced than most of the state in that sense. And John Wheeler, who was president of Mechanics and Farmers Bank and also, I guess, chairman or something of the Committee on the Affair, Committee on Negro Affairs, I believe they called it at that time. Now it's the Committee on the Affairs of Black Folks or something of that nature. But John Wheeler was a very hardworking person. He was trained as a lawyer, incidentally, in addition to being a banker. He graduated from North Carolina Central Law School. And he had worked hard to try to get blacks appointed to various positions, to put it very mildly. And so I'm sure that he pushed my appointment. First of all, he pushed an appointment of a black person to serve. And I had done some work with him in housing. And he was impressed, I think, with my work, and so I think that had a lot to do with Mr. Murdoch, who is the person who was the United States Attorney at that time. I think that had a lot to do with picking me as that particular person. But the interesting thing was the one of the questions that was asked at that time was when I went to the various parts of the Middle District to prosecute in the name of the United States, was where was I going to be able to stay at night? And it was a legitimate question, because there were lots of places where I could not stay. And I recall going up to Wilkesboro, and the question was, where was I going to stay up there? And to their credit, I was permitted to stay in the Wilkesboro Hotel, which was an old sort of historic-type hotel there. And as far as I know, I was treated just like other guests. But that those were the kind of questions that were asked. So it was a different era then than now.
Could we get away without the air conditioning? Do you think that would work for... Did Sam Irvin's feathers get ruffled at all by the appointment?
I'm not sure what his role was. The feeling was that both United States senators had to sign off on my appointment, so to speak. Now, this is an assistant United States attorney, not the United States attorney. This is an assistant United States attorney. But my feeling was that either of them could have kept me from being appointed. And so I think that both of them permitted it to happen, so to speak, even though Mr. Irvin, Senator Irvin at that time, did comment to the effect something like he thought the district attorney ought to pick whoever he wanted to for the positions, and that the United States Attorney General should not push people down his throat or something of that nature. But I think in spite of saying all that, I think he went along with it. That's my impression.
Mm-hmm. What kind of impression did the passage of the Civil Rights Act and Voting Rights Act make on your sense of the new prospects for evolving black political activity in North Carolina? How much did you make of those developments in those days?
Well, I thought it was a landmark act. I think its effect probably in some other states was greater than it was in North Carolina, to be honest with you. But I think it sort of set the stage for making a difference in terms of the elections, and making a difference in terms of respecting the black vote. Mm-hmm. And I think that people who were running after the act began to take effect, and that it made some difference, mm-hmm, in terms of what they could say, what they could do, what positions they could take, and things of that nature. Mm-hmm. And slowly it brought us to the point where we began to get more blacks elected to office. But I think the impact in North Carolina may have been more the effect upon white candidates than upon getting more the number of blacks elected. I think in the Democratic Party, which is again where the difference was made primarily, people who wanted to, who knew that it was right to include blacks in things as a part of the government, as a part of promoting them into positions and being inclusive, I think people who wanted to do it were able to do a little more, mm-hmm, now that they knew that the black vote was a part of their vote for, mm-hmm, being elected. And so I think it had an impact there as important as the impact it had in the sense of getting blacks actually elected to the various offices.
Right. Can you describe your decision? Why'd you enter politics in 66? Why did you want to make this run? What led you to that choice?
I'm sure there were a lot of things that played on that. And I guess a good start is when I went to Durham and saw blacks in suits in the bank at North Carolina Mutual Life Insurance Company, at Mechanics and Farmers Bank, at Mutual Savings and Loan Association, and I went to their cafeteria and I saw it seemed that blacks were doing things. And then I would leave and go out to other areas, and it, we were just so far behind in terms of progress, in terms of being a part of things and making decisions. And I thought that it ought to be different. And then I looked around at things like the state legislature, not a single black in the legislature. And at that time, there were some blacks who were running for the legislature. There was a gentleman from Winston-Salem, I recall, named Crawford, if I'm correct, who ran over there and lost. And then in 1964, I believe it was, Major High, a lawyer, black lawyer in Greensboro, ran and lost. And there were some others in other parts of the state. And I said, well, somebody ought to be able to run and get elected. And so I started talking with people around Greensboro and and was encouraged to run. And when one person in particular, Dr. Barnes, who was a dentist, an old gentleman, graduate of A&T also, said, well, if you run, I'll raise your money for you. And I said, well, boy, that sounds good. And so it was things like that that encouraged me to go ahead and run. And, of course, without going through it, I actually ran and lost in 1966, which surprised me and a lot of other folks because they thought I was going to – they just knew I was going to win. But I came in seventh, I think, out of when we were electing six, so I lost. I won big in the black community, and but I lost generally in the white community, and so that was the difference.
Your mention of Dr. Barnes raising money raises a point that I want to ask about. In these early campaigns, 66, 68, did you find it necessary to sort of make contact with certain black leaders across the state, or was it a very localized campaign?
It was local. Yeah. It was local. I may have gotten a few dollars from other places, but... for example, in that first race, Dr. Barnes was my treasurer. He wrote people and he called people, and then I had a finance committee, and so we did it locally.
So at that time, there was not yet any overarching effort by black leaders to work together in these local races across the state?
Not
other
that
than
I know
to
of.
Be generally sympathetic.
Yeah, not for local races, right?
Right.
I don't think so.
In the late 60s, can you sketch the key black leaders across the state? I'm thinking of Kelly Alexander, John Wheeler, Reginald Hawkins, maybe other folks. And what it was about their leadership positions that was significant?
Yeah. Oh, I'm not sure I can do that because I'd have to go back and kind of look at some things to be able to do that. You've named some of them, of course. There were lawyers who were fighting in the courts. Kenneth Lee in Greensboro, who also organized American Federal Savings and Loan Association. And there was John Stewart, who headed Mutual Savings and Loan. There was one of the Spaulding's, I get the order mixed up now, who with North Carolina Mutual, and several people at North Carolina Mutual who were very interested in doing things and were doing things. But to try to say who were the real ones, it'd be hard for me to say without kind of going back and concentrating on that particular period.
Mm-hmm. What were some of your first impressions of the House when you got here in 68 and the way politics worked in North Carolina there across the way?
Well, it was an interesting experience. First of all, I was the only black there, so I was a celebrity, so to speak. And so everybody wanted to meet me, and everybody wanted to talk to me, and everybody wanted to find out what I thought about this bill. And among the legislators wanted to know who I knew back in their community and things of that nature. And so I was treated extremely well. I was amazed at the complications, I guess, in terms of getting legislation through the legislature. It was a fascinating thing to try to follow it and to try to follow the number of bills. And I found myself working myself to death almost, trying to keep up with all of the details of the various bills, not only for the state generally, but some of the local bills which had impact. Racially, for example, the changing of various lines for school districts, and even the distribution of state's money to the various orphanages and things of that nature. I found that there was no objective plan that based it on anything that I thought was legitimate. And when we brought it out, a lot of people agreed with me, and we actually changed some of those things. In other words, it was not related to need. It was related more to the politics of the particular legislators, whatever they happened to be interested in. And so those were some of the things that were interesting. The other thing that is, I think, very important, and that is the laws relating to registration and voting in North Carolina at that time were antiquated, so to speak, and it, to an objective person, I think, it looked as though it was set up so as to keep people from voting, discourage them from voting, rather than encouraging them from voting. And so during that period and during the years after, several of us worked to open up the elective process, not just for blacks, but for poor whites, for example, and for people who were not sophisticated, you know, make it simple, make it easy, and that type of thing in terms of registering to vote, and in terms of the time element and things of that nature.
Your bill, when you introduced legislation in '69 to abolish the literacy test in North Carolina, it passed the House handily, about 4-1, and it passed the Senate with a vote to spare.
Well, when you say handily,
well, I'm looking just at the numbers. I had
looking at the numbers.
83-21.
Yes.
But maybe there's I'd like to ask you about that.
Yeah. Well, I have to give a little history on that. When I came out of service and went back home to register, I couldn't pass the literacy test. And they asked a lot of questions that had nothing to do with determining whether you were literate or not. And so when I went to the legislature in 1969, my first bill was a bill to abolish the literacy test. Now, of course, it had to amend the Constitution in order to do that. And the predictions of a lot of people were that it was just a waste of time, that the bill would never get through. But I lobbied the bill. I took the book with the list of the names of the legislators in the House. And I took them one at a time, one-on-one, and talked to them about the need for it and asked for their support and got support for many of them. And once I had enough, looked like I was going to have enough votes to pass it, then it became much easier to get a few more votes to go along with it. And we had an interesting debate on the floor about it, and it, as I said, it passed overwhelmingly, but not
until you did a little labor.
But we did a lot of work, and we carefully handled it, and even more so for the Senate, because the word was when it passed the House that they voted for it in the House and they will kill it in the Senate. And without going through details, I went to see several key members of the Senate. And I don't mind saying that Senator Ralph Scott was one of them. And he suggested who to go and talk to in the Senate to be sure that my bill got out of the committee. And I talked to the chair of the committee, and he let the bill come out of the committee. And of course, once it came out of the committee and got to the floor, I figured it was going to pass as it did.
The vote, you only lost a single vote in the Senate. What explains that level of support?
I'm not sure that I know, but I think that it became symbolic by this time. And one of the things, incidentally, that may have played a little role in the Senate is the Senate's a little different from the House, and I don't think it's changed very much, and that is this. On some things, it's like a closed-type society, and you don't oppose, if you oppose a bill, it's a major bill, it's sort of like opposing the person who introduced the bill. And I don't know how to describe that fully, but there was some of that at work. And so once I got certain people in the Senate to be for it, and it was sort of portrayed that this was, you know, I'm the first black in the legislature. This is my bill, and it kept me from being able to vote, and it would be an affront to me to vote against this thing. Now, back of that, of course, back in the local communities, I think most of them felt that supporting it would help them overall with certain voters in the community. Right. And so you put the two together, and I think that had an impression.
When it went out to the voters of the state, they turned it down, though.
Yes, but that battle was lost with the North Carolina Bar Association, I think.
Can you explain that? I don't know that.
Well, the North Carolina Bar Association had pushed a group of amendments to the Constitution. It pushed amending the total Constitution, and then a group of separate amendments to be voted on. And, of course, this one was not one of them. And at the Bar Association meeting that summer, before it was to be voted on, they took up the various amendments, including mine, and the board of directors or whoever made the decision for the Bar Association decided not to endorse my amendment. So the amendments endorsed by the Bar Association passed, and the one that was not endorsed, which was mine, of course, did not pass.
At the time, did you judge the fact that you and, I guess, Julius Chambers in 65 or 66 were the first couple African-Americans to desegregate the Bar Association? Was that still much at play, do you think, when this amendment question came up before the bar?
I don't know the extent to which that was involved. And I think we had come into the Bar Association earlier than that.
Earlier than 65 or 66.
Oh no, about that time.
Right.
See, this was 70.
Right.
This was 70
right.
when the amendment was taken up. But we had been admitted to the Bar Association. I don't think our admittance as such had anything to do with it. I think in all fairness that the bar at that point had a group of amendments that they wanted passed. And they didn't want anything to interfere with it. And my amendment was an interference. And so I think the group prevailed that, look, you know, let's don't mess up our stuff with this. Mm-hmm. I think that's what prevailed, but I don't know that. I have to admit I was extremely disappointed when they did not endorse it.
Mm-hmm. What kind of relationship did you have early on with the key Democratic Party players and with Bob Scott, the governor?
I had a good relationship with Bob Scott, as far as I know, and I had supported him, of course, in the primary election. And I said, of course, I don't even remember the primary, but in the election, and because I don't remember what his competition was in the primary. That's the reason I said I don't remember. But Bob Scott, I was able to work with him very well. During my term in the legislature when he was there, and I forgot what your other question was and we left reference to him.
What did the party's key leaders make of this new, the first black legislator, and how are they going to or not begin to adjust the nature of the party to accommodate the coming wave of black political participation?
Yeah, well, there was a movement right about that time, and I'm not sure the exact years now, to change the Democratic Party to provide for more representation. Now, there were two things going on, though. One was the involvement of blacks and to some extent Indians and that type of thing. But also there was the women's movement, because women were not in the leadership roles in the party. And so I was a part of a group, and I think it was headed by then, I think it was headed by Hunt before he became...
That's right.
Was it before he became lieutenant governor? I'm
I
not
think
sure.
That's right.
But yes, to change the rules, to really put in a provision to have members of opposite sex, for example, and different races and things in the various positions. So there was a movement to do that, and to some extent it was successful.
I guess that movement followed the convention challenge in '68 that Reginald Hawkins had led, in part anyway.
Yes. Yes,
and resulted in Howard Lee's appointment in 70 as, what was his title? He became a, Howard Lee became, I don't remember his title, but anyway, second vice chair of the state Democratic Party. That's what it was.
Yeah, well, Howard Lee was beginning to be a moving party at that time. He was elected mayor of Chapel Hill, if you recall, and was really an upcoming star, so to speak. And a lot of credit, though, does have to be given to Reginald Hawkins for being the kind of person who could stir people up and get them interested in doing things. And actually, his running helped my election in Guilford County. I mean, he was running statewide, but he was criticizing the so-called establishment and saying that things have got to change and come out and vote for me to make those changes. And while only a certain number came out to vote for him, among blacks in particular, a lot of them came to vote for him and voted for me. So he helped other blacks get elected to positions.
It sounds from these developments as if by, say, 1970 or thereabouts, generally speaking, you would have had a relatively, at least cautiously optimistic view at the least of the prospects for honest and fair roles for blacks in the Democratic Party as the years went forward.
Yeah. I think that's correct.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Different question. What did you make of Holzhauser's election in 72? Helms wins the Senate race that year, and for the first time you've got a Republican governor in the 20th century. What kind of sense did Democrats, say, here in Raleigh, make of that election and the success of Holzhauser and Helms?
Yeah. Well, obviously there were some very disappointed Democrats. In the legislature, we formed a... I've forgotten the title of it, something like the equivalent of a committee of Democrats to meet on a regular basis and sort of plan programs and strategies and things of that nature in terms of what we would be doing in the legislature. Now that was in addition to, of course, then Lieutenant Governor Hunt, trying to put things together for his program and things of that nature. I have to tell you that I got along extremely well with Holzhauser. He was a very decent person, and in some sense was a fairly decent governor, to tell you the truth. and a likable person, really. At least that was my experience with him. And he probably worked as well, if not better than. Well, I don't want to get into present politics. Sure. I'm about to get into that. I don't want to do that.
would Democrats back in the early mid 70s, looking say at Jesse Helms' candidacy and so forth, were Democrats yet much worried in a direct and weighty way about how they were going to handle the whole question of integrating blacks as a component of their coalition in a sort of a pragmatic, practical sense, political sense?
I'm not sure I know how to answer that one. I would have to think yes, but to remember exactly what they were doing generally and that type of thing, I don't have a vivid. I remember a lot of talk, and I remember the Democratic. I went to the Democratic conventions, the statewide ones and the local ones. I was very very active at that time, but to try to remember the specifics, it's a little difficult for me at this point.
I'm thinking, for example, of in the early years of the 70s, Nixon's Southern strategy and anti-busing approaches and so forth. I mean, he was clearly trying to begin to drive that wedge in to separate off traditional white Southern Democrats from their allegiance to the Democratic Party. And I wondered how much that was at play in conversations and strategy sessions for Democratic Party leaders here in North Carolina in those years, but it's difficult to recall.
A lot of us talked about it, but I'm not sure that I was quite at the top where where the real decisions were being made in terms of what the party was going to do.
Who would you have said, who were those key leaders?
Well, here we are again in the 70s, right?
Yeah. Hunt's lieutenant governor.
Yeah, lieutenant governor. And, of course, Burt Bennett, who was one of his major backers, mm-hmm. of course. But then you had people in the Senate. I think Ralph Scott was an important player in those days, and Kenneth Royal was rising to a very important position in those days. And let's see, I'm trying to think of who was the Speaker of the House at that time. I went through several speakers who were strong during their term, but they could not repeat themselves, not succeed themselves.
I guess when you came in at 69, Earl Vaughn,
yes.
Then Phil Godwin, mm-hmm. James Ramsey, Jimmy Green, mm-hmm. and Carl Stewart.
Yeah. Jimmy Green was a very, very important player in those days. Very important. And, of course, as you know, he went on to other things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
One thing I want to ask about before we move on to some other things, how about your efforts on the capital punishment front while you were in the House?
Yeah. Well, we went through a change in North Carolina and I guess throughout the country in terms of the death penalty. At one point, it was available for a large number of crimes. And I'm thinking at the time I started that it may have been the death penalty available for four crimes in North Carolina. I think that was correct. And eventually we dropped it down to the point it was the only crime as a practical matter for which you would get the death penalty was first-degree murder. And that was also during the time when the Supreme Court was sort of changing things in terms of what could be done. But basically, my position at that time was that the death penalty was used primarily for people who were down and out, not the ordinary people of society, but it was used against not just blacks, poor whites, and others who were down and out, so to speak, disadvantaged, and that it was so disproportionate. And also, a lot of people didn't get particularly good representation. And so there was the fear of executing innocent people. And I think that played on my position more so than anything else, just the very thought that we would be executing innocent people. So my position was to try to abolish the death penalty and have only life imprisonment as the punishment for crime in North Carolina. Mm-hmm. I hasten to say that things are, while they haven't changed completely, that things are a lot better today. The representation is just, I mean, it's miles and miles ahead of where it was. And it's highly unlikely today that you would execute a person, though it could happen.
Who were emerging as the key black leaders across the decade of the 70s besides yourself? And I'm thinking not just of those persons elected, say, to roles in Raleigh, but also mm-hmm. in communities across the state. Who would you have?
Mm-hmm. Well, we had blacks who were elected mayors of some cities, and they, of course, were very, very key people.
Mm-hmm.
You had those who were president of their NAACP chapters in areas throughout, who were very, very important people.
Mm-hmm.
And we were beginning to get them, for example, sometimes as many as two, for example, on a city council and some on county commissioners and things of that nature. But to get the names, mm-hmm. I'm not focused on that area at that particular time. So it's hard for me to do it. And I've mentioned in Wheeler and some of those
mm-hmm.
people. And I'm trying to think of And, of course, the head of the NAACP, Kelly Alexander, was of course, very important right. in terms of what was done. And I think to some extent the black newspapers had a had an important role. In Wilmington, can't even think of the guy's name down there who has run the paper and owned it for years and years and years. And then we had the Carolina Times with Alston in Durham and the Carolinian here in Raleigh. And I think, if I recall, the two, either brothers or cousins, one owned the paper in Wilmington and the other one ran the one here in Raleigh. And so those newspapers, I think, the heads of those newspapers, the owners, the people who really ran them, and in Greensboro with the Carolina Peacemaker, with John Marshall Kilimanjaro. The other thing that fit into this whole thing was while some were working in one area, others were working in other areas. You know, for example, you got your economic area, you had certain of the business people who were making a difference, making an impact. Then you had others in the political arena who were making a difference. And then you had the presidents, for example, then of the various black colleges, mm-hmm. and sometimes the principals of the schools, mm-hmm. who were very influential in terms of what was being done and what changes were taking place and things of that nature. Mm-hmm. So,
did as a few more faces began to show up in the House here, can you tell me the story of how you began to the earliest days, say, of what would become the Legislative Black Caucus?
Yes. All right, I came in 69. In 71, George Johnson, who was a minister from down in Robeson County, and he was a minister and a Baptist minister and a fiery Baptist minister, so to speak. So that was the Black Caucus. And
Whenever the two of you got together.
Which was fairly frequent. And then right shortly after that, we had Mickey Mashaw and Richard Irwin who came. And then in the Senate, about that same time, we had two people,
Fred Alexander.
Fred Alexander and guy here from Raleigh.
John Winters?
John Winters, right. By this time, when we got all of us there, we had enough to have a caucus. And we met on a regular basis and tried to agree on basic positions and tried to sort of divide the work up, because there were so many areas to watch for. The changing of the election laws, one thing. The school boards and changing the school lines was another of great importance. Mm-hmm. And just the general election laws. And then bills relating to workforce. I mean, it was just a whole broad range of things. And not to mention the criminal laws that were being changed at this particular time in various ways. Mm-hmm. And so we would sometimes try to divide up so that one would watch one area a little more and another one would watch another area and that type of thing. And so we did try to do some coordinating.
Yeah. What kind of relationship did the Black Caucus have with the party's leadership back in the mid-late 70s?
Yeah. Well, where we were together on something, it was an important part. Mm-hmm. But we were about as diverse in some things as the rest of the legislature. So there were only in a few areas where we took positions. And we were never a formal organization not nearly as much so as it is now, for example, with annual banquets and all of those things. We didn't have any of that.
Were there issues that tended sort of to illustrate the basic relationship of this informal Black Caucus to the leadership? Were there things maybe differences of political interest really were sharply defined? For example, was the caucus or the informal caucus interested, uh-huh. say, in moving in a more progressive direction with tax or fiscal policy?
As I recall, there were a group of us, for example, who were interested in what we call some tax reform. And I'm trying to think. I think all of the black members were together on that. But we went through the stages where at one point, as I recall, the funds were short, and the question was, how are you going to get the money you needed? And there was a question of whether you're going to go with tobacco or whether you will go with something else and that type thing. The black legislators from the tobacco areas were a little more lenient towards the tobacco position, I guess. In other words, race was only one part of the agenda. I guess that's the best way I know how to put it.
Mm-hmm. Looking back, what would you say? And I know we've probably got, about 10 minutes?
Mm-hmm. Maybe eight.
Maybe eight. As you look back on your, I guess, 12 years in the six terms in the House and then a term in the Senate, what would you point to as how would you describe the landscape of influence at work in state politics in North Carolina? Who were the key centers of political influence at work in North Carolina? Thinking of, tobacco, textiles, emerging new industries, how would you have sort of sorted out that mix?
You need to talk to a historian trying to put things into perspective. I'm not sure I know how to answer that. For the most part, during those days, we were elected in the larger places, we were elected at large. We tended not to be one-issue people. I guess that's one way of putting it. It's hard to kind of, I guess, for me to sit back and try to judge what was going on, if you understand what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
I remember from my own experience that the first few years, it seems that people were more interested in several things, whereas as I got near the end of my term, it seemed that people were becoming more one-issue voters. So that when I ran the first few times, I had agenda, and I would have, say, five or six or seven things that I was interested in, which I thought were good for the state, okay? And people seemed to pay attention to that. But as we got nearer to the, before I left, there would be a strong group that was either pro-abortion or anti-abortion. There was another group that was either for the I guess you would call it the textile mills and those groups and so forth, and then another group who were sort of they were trying to get something done in terms of legislation to deal with brown lung disease and things of that nature. And so they were a single issue, and I don't care what you think on about anything else, but we're going to make our decision based on this one thing. And then we had others who were either capital punishment or opposed, for it or against it. And so that was one trend that I observed that became very noticeable, and that is just single issue things,
mm-hmm.
Which I think hurt our situation in North Carolina, which is where, of course, I was running, and in Guilford County, which is the area I was running from.
Sure. Yeah. Last couple quick questions. You decided not to seek a second Senate term. What were there reasons of relevance in this context that led you to that choice in 82?
Not as such. I had been in for a good while, and I was beginning. It was sort of a combination of two primary things. One is, I was beginning to get upset with the one-issue type things. I wanted people to look at me on three or four things rather than just one thing, and that did tend to bother me a little bit. The other one, frankly, is that I down the road had an idea of probably, frankly, running for governor of North Carolina. I put it very bluntly. I didn't broadcast this, but I thought that I would go for some other political position, and governor was the one that appealed to me most. And I was trying to practice law and serve in the legislature, and my law partners told me that I was not pulling my load in terms of bringing in the money for the law firm. Not in bringing it in. They say I brought it in, but it didn't help get it out. So to put it in, there was the economic thing. So I said I was going to leave the legislature, and I was going to go home and practice law and make some money and get all my bills paid and everything, and then take a look down the road to see if I would be able to go into some real political thing, either governor or lieutenant governor, or go for the Senate or something of that nature. And after a few months of that, the offer came to go to the Supreme Court, and I accepted it.
Right. One last question, because I know we're out of time here, but...